You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered.
Listener supported.
Community radio from South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community. And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Don Guerra.
And I'm Erin Wagermiller. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, February 27th, 2018.
We're seeing this across the forest, this lack of diversity inside our caves now, and the lack of the numbers. So little browns have been hit really hard from white nose syndrome. And it's being reflected on the forest. It's rough to find them in the numbers we used to.
Coming up later in the program, WFHB correspondent Jonah Chester speaks with foresters about a devastating fungal infection found in Indiana caves. Chester speaks with ecologists about white nose syndrome, which has all but wiped out bat populations across the state and forced the closure of many caves across southern Indiana. That's coming up in today's feature report.
In this week's edition of the Bicentennial Journal, Bob Hamill tells the story of George Shively, a professional African-American baseball player who was born the son of a slave. Shively was buried in an unmarked grave in Rose Hill Cemetery until recently, when the indignity of his burial was brought to light. That's coming up in this week's edition of the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana. But first, your daily headlines.
The city of Bloomington is holding two public meetings tonight about the planned purchase of an armored vehicle for the city's police department. Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton announced the additional public meetings on Friday. The Board of Public Safety, which oversees the fire and police departments in the city, will hold a special session for public comment from 5:30 to 6:30 this evening. And the city is hosting an open house for public feedback at 6:30 tonight. Bloomington Police Department Chief Mike Dekoff and members of the Critical Incident Response Team, who would use the vehicle, are expected to be in attendance at the open house meeting. Both meetings will take place at Bloomington City Hall. Another open house meeting is scheduled for this Thursday at noon. The meetings come a day after the Bloomington chapter of Black Lives Matter released a list of demands, following a screening of a documentary last night at the Buskirk Chumley Theater. Among those demands were stopping the purchase of the Lenkoke Bearcat armored car, the public release of all documents pertaining to the purchase, the provision of two other options by mid-March, time for public comment on other options, and the formation of a committee to investigate the armored car purchase. According to Herald Times, several activist organizations were behind the release of demands to Mayor Hamilton's office. The city administration is expected to announce a final decision on the purchase of the Bearcat armored car before the end of March.
The city of Bloomington announced they'll be partnering with bike share company Zagster to implement an agreement with Indiana University. The bike share project was first announced in October, and the first bikes are expected to arrive in Bloomington in April or May. Originally, city officials stated 150 bikes are planned, but they hope to grow that number to around 8,000. The bike share is expected to run almost entirely off a cell phone application. The bike share is currently not expected to cost any payment for the city. IU researchers have reportedly been helping city officials with mapping out the most popular routes around Bloomington.
Governor Eric Holcomb toured parts of southern Indiana yesterday after torrential rain led state officials to declare a state of emergency in 18 counties. WFHB's Chu Han Chia brings us this report.
Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb and Indiana Homeland Security Director Brian Lindley visited several Ohio River counties yesterday, many of which were inundated by flooding over the weekend. Holcomb and Lindley inspected flood damage in Clark, Jefferson, and Dearborn counties, all of which are on the Ohio River. According to the governor's office, The pair met with local officials and learned about response and recovery efforts. Over the last week, Indiana received heavy rainfall, which caused the Ohio to overflow its banks. The State Emergency Operations Center says they've been providing assistance and coordination in conjunction with county-level responders. Holcomb declared a disaster on Saturday for 11 counties because of flooding. The flooding has demolished or caused severe damage to homes and businesses, as well as infrastructure in the southern part of the state. On Monday, the governor's office added 7 more counties to the disaster declaration, bringing the total to 18 counties. The emergency declaration allows the state to offer additional resources to assist local response efforts. A state emergency operations center was activated last Wednesday. According to a press release, the center ordered and arranged over 750,000 sandbags, 2 water pumps, and loaned heavy equipment and vehicles to local disaster efforts. The state says residents should be on the lookout for warnings before they travel on highways or local roads. Hoosiers can find more information about currently closed highways through the InDOT mobile app or online. The state has also set up a page for uninsured damage claims at dhs.in.gov. So far, the state has not reported anyone dying as a result of the flooding. For WFHB, I'm Chu Hanjie.
Tomorrow, Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb is expected to sign a bill that would repeal the state's prohibition on the Sunday carryout sale of alcohol. Senate Bill 1 would allow the retail sale of alcohol between noon and 8 p.m. on Sundays. Indiana has not allowed the sale of alcohol on Sundays since Prohibition in 1920. The governor's signature tomorrow could mean the sale of alcohol on Sundays in the state as soon as this weekend. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Don Guerra.
And I'm Aaron Wagermiller. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
Indiana's caves, largely focused around the southern karst topography of the state, are reopening after being closed for years. The Hoosier National Forest prohibited entrance to its caves to visitors for fear of spreading a deadly fungal infection that's ravaged bat populations across the state. As WFHB correspondent Jonah Chester reports, the death of millions of bats has dire implications for other parts of the state's and world's ecosystem.
Southern Indiana is full of caves. The unique limestone-based geology of the area makes the region prone to caverns and sinkholes. These geological features provide shelter and an ecosystem to a surprisingly wide array of animal and insect life. In the past several years, however, a disease known as white nose syndrome has swept through Indiana's cave systems. The disease is a fungal infection that has killed countless bats and moved several bat species dangerously close to the endangered species list. The disease became so bad that the Hoosier National Forest and other federal lands indefinitely closed down their caves in 2009. The caves are reopening this summer, but only because the damage to the cave's ecosystem has already been done. I wanted to see firsthand how this disease was impacting the cave ecosystem, so I joined a team of Hoosier National Forest scientists on a routine checkup on 2 caves in the forest system. They perform these checks several times throughout the winter season in order to have an idea of where the bat population stands and if there have been any major disturbances to their hibernation. We met up at the main offices in Bedford and then drove to the first cave we'd be examining.
We've got about 4 or 5 caves that we historically check every year to get a trend data for bat counts.
Got it.
This particular one, these caves that we check in the wintertime, You know, we don't do a lot of checking in the summer. We have it in the past, but you don't get the cave usage by bats like you do in the wintertime.
Got it, yeah.
In the summer. So.
This is Steve Harris, wildlife biologist and cave coordinator for the Hoosier National Forest.
So I think I told you last time we had about 200 caves on the forest.
Yeah.
We find a few every year. But we only check, we only have time to check so much with all our other workload and everything. So we try to get about 10 or a dozen every winter. Four or five of them are the historic ones we do, and then we add on four or five new ones every year, see if something has changed in the other caves.
In addition to performing routine checkups on the forest caves, almost everybody else on the team performs a number of other duties. With a 200,000 square foot forest, everybody has to pull their weight to make things work.
We wear many hats on the Hoosier since we're a small forest. So we typically do three or four collateral duties everybody does. We all assist with wildfires and prescribed burning. We help out other shops as needed, recreation or engineering. Then we do our main jobs, you know, biology and technicians and... But that's what makes it interesting on the forest.
Most of the caves only require one or maybe two checkups per year. Even though everybody on the forest's cave team are highly trained and educated, they still risk disturbing the bats' hibernation just by their general presence.
And that's one reason why the caves are closed during the wintertime, is for their protection. They can't take constant interruptions or disturbance. By us checking the caves... You know, once a year, you know, they're not going to get that disturbance that would mess them up. It's natural for them to wake up a little bit during the wintertime. They might get a drink or they might reposition themselves or clean themselves. That's a natural thing. But constant disturbance, people on top of them all the time, that's where they expend their energy more, and then they'll deplete the reserves.
On this trip, the team was looking at three particular bat species in two different caves. According to Harris, Indiana's cave systems used to be very biologically diverse. But in recent years, due to white nose syndrome, the diversity in the ecosystem has seen a stark drop-off.
Historically, we'd have approximately three different species in this cave. We'd have big browns, we'd have the eastern pipistrelle, or now it's called the tricolor, and we would have little browns. But the last time we were in here, I think we only saw tricolor bats. So we'll see what it brings today.
So do the other bats just die off, or are they just... the other species, rather.
It's a good question. We're seeing this across the forest, this lack of diversity inside our caves now, and the lack of the numbers. So little browns have been hit really hard from white nose syndrome, and it's being reflected on the forest. It's rough to find them in the numbers we used to. Let me help you out here a little bit, Brian. There we go.
It was raining pretty hard the day I accompanied the team to the cave. The noise you're hearing in the background is us hiking through deep ponds just to get to the cave. On the way, Harris discussed the changes he's seen in the caves since the onset of white nose syndrome.
You know, their patterns were changing. You know, historically, we'll show you when we get inside where they usually have been. And we've been, I've been looking at this cave since like almost 15 years worth of data.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a good idea of where they should be, where they always were, how many we should have before white nose. And then when white nose hit, you know, all bets are off.
Yeah.
So all their patterns changed.
When examining caves like those in the forest, scientists divide the caverns into three distinct categories.
You can divide that cave into three different parts: a drip zone, a twilight zone, and a dark zone.
Okay.
We take temperatures right here at the drip zone, right where the rock faces, mm-hmm. Right where it's dripping.
Yeah.
We get inside a little ways where you don't really need your headlamp. You can still see daylight.
Yeah.
That's the twilight zone. And then if you can't see any daylight at all, obviously that's the dark zone.
Got it. Okay.
And there's different critters that live in each zones.
And the bats, where do the bats typically inhabit again?
The dark zone, but they can edge toward the twilight zone a little bit.
Got it.
In this particular cave, it's hard to say in all caves, you can't put that standard on every single cave to be exact.
Okay. Understood. The team doesn't have a precise method for measuring the health of the bats. They try to avoid coming into physical contact with them for risk of disturbing their hibernation. Instead, they just perform visual checks to ascertain the general well-being of the cave and to be sure the bats have a clean and safe environment to hibernate in.
And it's not a full-blown research monitoring trip. It's mostly visual. We don't have any set parameters on here.
Got it.
This tree is 1 inch taller than it was last year. I'm looking for trash and you kind of get a feel for the use of it. We obviously have a trail running down through here, mm-hmm. So it gets its use.
Yeah. And I have to imagine the trail, given that this cave is supposed to have been closed for the past 10 years, aside from you guys, or roughly the past 10 years, it looks like it's gotten kind of frequent use, despite that.
It is. And one of the, it's a well-known area where we're at.
Yeah.
It's a national landmark.
Yeah.
So people want to come down here, and they don't understand the rules, they don't know the policies, they see this, let's go check it out. Mm-hmm. And they might not go all the way back in, but we've definitely found, trash and graffiti inside the cave.
While in the cave, the team made efforts to find and create a count of the hibernating bats in the dark zone. According to Harris, they were looking for signs of any drop-off in numbers, potentially indicating that the bats had died, or if the bats had moved a significant distance from the last time they had checked the cave the previous month. We spent around an hour and a half slipping and sliding through the cave before re-emerging. From there, we progressed to the second cave about half a mile away.
Oh, it feels better out here.
I know.
Yeah. It's just that fresh breeze. I'm loving it.
The first cave wasn't very conducive to bats hibernation, according to Harris. They tend to prefer a cooler, drier environment. This second cave we visited would have, at one point, housed several dozen hibernating bats. When we finally entered the cave, however, there were only around half a dozen. Unfortunately, that's not uncommon. According to the National Forest Service, the average mortality rate for bats infected with white nose syndrome is around 90%. While we were crouched in the cave performing the counts and trying our best not to disturb the bats, I asked Harris if we had seen the worst of the disease come and go, and if the majority of the damage had already been done. He responded that we can only hope so, but that nobody is really sure. Reporting for WFHB, I'm Jonah Chester.
You're listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB.
Coming up next, the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana.
Monroe County's Bicentennial Committee presents the Bicentennial Journal, stories celebrating the rich history of Monroe County.
This is my Monroe County story. I'm Bob Hamill. A few lines in his June 9, 1962 obituary section told Bloomington Herald telephone readers of the death at 67 of George Shively, quote, a well-known amateur baseball player who lived most of his life here. Amateur? Try professional. And well-known? His passing didn't get even a mention on the sports page. He was buried at Rose Hill Cemetery in an unmarked grave. More than 50 years later, when the Monroe County Sports Hall of Fame came into being and the search was on for early day stars who deserved inclusion, the story began to take shape of just how genuinely well-known this baseball player named George Shively once was. He was bountifully blessed with baseball's essentials. He could run and hit and chase down fly balls with the best of them. He just couldn't play with the best of them in baseball's major leagues because he was black. George had been born on a Kentucky tobacco farm, first generation son of a freed slave. He and his father, along with George's two sisters, moved to Bloomington in time to be listed as residents here in the 1900 census. At Bloomington's, quote, colored school, unquote, in the 6th Washington block that later became the site of a Carnegie Library, now the Monroe County History Center, George went as far as 5th grade. Then he went to work. In his teens, he made the starting outfield for the professional West Baden Sprudels, whose daily rivalry with the neighboring French Lick Plutos was summer entertainment for the high society guests at the two luxury hotels. In 1914, about the time George turned 20, the nucleus of the West Baden team went with manager C.I. Taylor to form the Indianapolis ABC's team that played in and won the championship of the new Negro American League. Young outfielder and leadoff man George Shively was an all-star and the league's most valuable player. He went on to win another MVP trophy and make the All-Star team 7 times. It's pretty apparent that he was the best baseball player ever to grow up in Bloomington or Monroe County. He had a 14-year pro career, traveling throughout the U.S. and abroad. When the speed and the skills weren't there anymore, he came back to Bloomington, where he was employed as a roofer, into his 60th year when he died and went to his unmarked grave. When the Hall of Fame sleuthers went to work half a century later, Google was available to tell the story that newspapers of George Shively's day missed. The story was made public, including the unmarked grave indignity, and the Bloomington community responded with generosity that financed the handsome limestone marker that now calls attention to where the great baseball player George Shively is buried, and separate markers for George's wife Lula and each of the 8 other African Americans were buried in anonymity in the same Rose Hill plot, and one for George's father, Joseph, whose actual burial site at Rose Hill was uncertain. On a sunny Sunday afternoon, April 5th, 2012, Easter Sunday for Christians, opening day for another Major League season in a sport now enriched with African-American stars, a crowd of Bloomington citizens came to Rose Hill to see that marker dedicated. The presiding minister was two-time IU football All-American, the Reverend Anthony Thompson. The rich, powerful voice of IU professor Tim Noble that has launched 100 Hoosier basketball games at Assembly Hall with the national anthem on that afternoon sang Amazing Grace. Amazing. The voices Nove singing group sang. It was an unforgettable day. Way, way overdue, but unforgettable. And that community-sponsored grave marker stands as one of Rose Hill's many tourist treasures. Make a point to go see it.
Join us next week for another edition of the Monroe County Bicentennial Journal. Support for the Bicentennial Journal and WFHB comes from Monroe County and Visit Bloomington. More information about Monroe County's Bicentennial is available at monroecounty200.us.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Wes Martin and Chuhan Chia, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, which is a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Jonah Chester.
The Bicentennial Journal is produced by Kate Welsh, with help from Joyce Poling. Our engineer is Megan Wade. Our theme music is provided by Ben Lumstein, Scott Schmadke, and Danny Graff. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, I'm Aaron Wagermiller.
And I'm Don Guerra. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news at WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for Counterspin, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's weekly radio show, providing a critical examination of national headlines. That's coming up next on WFHB.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB Bloomington Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@wfhb.org. You can become a Daily Local News volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. You can find an archive of past shows and individual news reports online at wfhb.org and catch live broadcasts of the Daily Local News Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m. We are local, longer.